What I'll be talking about today is mostly based on the work in this first paper that came out late last year, both being Yankee and Rin Butler. And also some things I've been doing with Kintara recently. And to a lesser extent, the work that appeared in this older paper about a year ago. So the claim that I'd like to convince you of today is that there are certain planar graphs on the two torus that encode a lot of information about the geometry of local toric Calabi-Yau manifolds. They also know about mirror symmetry for these manifolds, and they also know a lot of information about the topological B-brains on the toric Calabi-Yau and the A-brains on the mirror Calabi-Yau. So all this information is somehow encoded in these kinds of graphs, these two examples. I'll be focusing mostly on one example today. The physical application of this is that in string theory we have some D-brain trapping some supersymmetric cycles in our Calabi-Yau manifold, and the walled volume theory of these D-brains will be a supersymmetric gauge theory with n equals 1 supersymmetry. And what these graphs, these dynamo models, can tell us is about the holomorphic sector of these theories. So in particular, they will allow us to compute things that have been computed using other methods, but much more easily. And they also can teach us information about the geometry of the D-brains themselves. So to fix my conventions in my my setup, so I'll be looking at Calabi-Yau which have a certain form, so restricted to a certain class. They're all non-compact and they're toric. Toric means there's a global U1 cubed isometry which extends to C star cubed action on the space. Being toric restricts actually to that these things are on complex cones over a toric four manifold. I won't be using leverage value C of T today, but the same class of theories and everything I say, in fact, will have a translation in a C of T language. Instead of thinking about the space as being a complex cone, if you look at it as a real cone, it's a cone over a Sarpi-Einstein 5 manifold, and taking the horizon geometry gives you a space for this form. And people have studied the same theories in this context as well. So the canonical example of such a space is if you take a P2 and take the anticanonical line bundle, total space of the anticanonical line bundle over it, denoted by O minus 3 over P2. So I'll be looking at D-brains that fill the transverse 3 plus 1 dimensions and then wrap some, well, for B-side D-brains wrapping a monomorphic cycle on the Calabi-Yau. And the walled volume theory of these theories is extended in the transverse directions and preserves n equals 1 supersymmetry. So to study the vacua of such a theory, I have to solve two types of problem. I have to solve air flatness conditions and also deep flatness. And the common theme is that the air flatness are the ones that is to do with this holomorphic data, which is accessible to the dynamo models that I'll be telling you about. And studying deep flatness is really some sort of stability condition on the D-brains. It's a constraint that we look at D-brains that are mutually BPS. And this seems to be harder to study within this context. So an important point is that the holomorphic data, the F-terms, depend only on the complex structure moduli, and conversely, the D-terms depend on the Kähler moduli. With the class of these toric theories, when I have my singularity resolved, there are no complex structure deformations possible. So all I can do is deform the Kähler moduli. In this case, it's just the size of P2, and so this makes it very simple to, well, you can see a lot of the so the air flatness doesn't depend on the size of the P2. It doesn't depend where you are in the Kähler moduli space. So one thing you can do is to shrink the size to zero. Well, it's more complicated than that because of stringy correction, but there's a point in the Kähler moduli space where the where the space becomes singular, and in particular it has an orbifold singularity. So to get a concrete example of what goes on the Voigt volume we take some NG free range, we put them at the singular point, and we can ask what happens on their Voigt volume. So this problem has been studied for many years. It was first studied in the physics literature by Douglas and Moore. And in the case of an orbifold singularity, the Voigt volume theory is determined by representation theory of the orbifold group. Without going into details, what you find in the Z3 example is that instead of having a single stack of D3 brains sitting at a point, the D3 brain is kind of fragmented into three objects, which are labeled by the vertices here. This graph indicates the matter concept. What it says is that there are three gastrics, which are associated with three fractional brains, which are supported, they're localized at a singular point, and then there are some fundamental matter stretch between them. And in this case, it turns out there are three bifundamental fields. So these are in the M bar of these two gastrics, and similarly the other three. There are nine fields altogether, and their gastric indices are encoded by the quiver graph. It's called a quiver graph. So the other thing we need to specify is the superpotential at tree level, and it turns out in this case it has a cubic form, which I can write in this fashion. The coupling constants that you might want to put in front of each of these terms, it turns out they can always be absorbed by rescaling the fields that you have there. The reason for this is because generically coupling constants in the superpotential correspond to complex structure moduli of the space. And as I mentioned a moment ago, for these theories, there are no complex structure deformations when we're away from the singular point. So it means, well, that's the translation of this fact. It's only when you have complex structure deformations of your exceptional cycle that you get coupling constants in W. Okay, so. So suppose I have such a theory, it has this matter content, it has these interactions. So finding a vacuum in this theory means I have to solve the F-lightness constraints, and also there are some D terms, because I have a U1 factor in each of these gauge groups, it means I can have an FI parameter associated to them. So you can see already here, this is where the Kähler parameters enter. Each of these FI parameters are real, and there are three of them, but they're subject to a constraint. And these two degrees of freedom correspond to the map in some manner to the Kähler, the complexified Kähler parameter. Okay, so if you just are just interested in studying the F flatness, so finding field configurations that are F flat, then this problem is accessible to the topological B model on the Calabi-Yau. Broadly speaking, the set of topological B brains doesn't depend on where you are in Kähler moduli space. So no matter where you are, it's the same set of objects that satisfies the constraints. And imposing a BPS condition or stability condition corresponds to having a solution of the D-flatness constraints. And that depends where you are in Kähler moduli space. The mirror to this statement is that on the mirror manifold W, the topological A brains are independent of the complex structure. Now, I'll be using this later. I'll be varying the complex structure of my mirror, but I know I don't have to worry about, I have the same set of objects everywhere. Okay, so this is kind of the example to keep in mind of the kinds of theories that one can obtain from these D-brain Voigt volumes. And now I'll introduce the Dynamo models and show how they reproduce the data of these theories. So I gave a talk here sometime last year where I talked in much more detail about about this correspondence, but I'll just give a summary. So the basic idea is that you can combine the data that I gave before, the matter content encoded by this quiver graph and a superpotential into a single object, which is a planar graph drawn on a 2 torus. It turns out one can always do this operation when the Calabi manifold is toric. The reason for that will, I guess, be one of the main points from my talk, but just for now you can take that as given. So how does this work? So the dictionary for this correspondence is here. So the faces of this tiling correspond to the nodes of the quiver. These were the gauge groups of the gauge series. There were three of them, and then the three faces of this tiling. The edges are dual to these by fundamental matter fields. So for example, the X1, 2, X1, 2, 1, not actually as very readable as I hope. X1, 2, 1 is the field there, it goes from gauge group 1, and gauge group 2, and so on. And the terms in W, the cubic terms in the superpotential, are encoded by the vertices. So a cubic vertex corresponds to a cubic term in W. So so here we have x1, 2, 3, x2, 3, 2, and x3, 1, 1, which is one of the terms there, and similarly with all the others. And in fact, the sign is also encoded by the colouring that I gave to the vertex. So I coloured the vertex with a solid or an open circle, and that's plus or minus 1 in some convention. So at this level, you can just think of these dimographs as being useful tools for combining these two separate objects into one combinatorial object. And it's quite useful just as a bookkeeping device. Many people have used this as a tool for studying or organizing studies of the gauge series. Things like you can study cascading G flows if you take the ranks of these gauge groups to be different. You can study confining behavior in infrared and so on. So this is a bookkeeping device that already quite useful. But my main interest was trying to find a realization of these things in string theory. Why should these structures exist, and why should they be, where do they come from? Why should we believe it? So that's what I'll be coming to later. So one way I like of getting a handle on that is to study the geometry that you can derive from these graphs. So I'll start by explaining how the geometry of the Calabi-Yau manifold emerges from looking at combinatorics of these graphs. So the key point is really that that there are things called dimer configurations or perfect matchings on these graphs, and these are in some sense natural variables for satisfying the F-flatness constraints. So what is a dimer configuration? A dimer is just a mark edge, so I color in edges, but I want to cover each vertex on my graph exactly once. So here, if it's not clear, this edge has a dimer, that edge is a dimer, and this edge, which is the same as this edge, has a dimer. So they cover all six vertices of that graph exactly once. So you can just work these out quite easily. There are six of them all together. And the claim is that these dimer configurations in this graph have something to do with solving the F-flatness constraints. So one thing that's quite nice about this graphical representation of the gauge theory is that the F-flatness constraints have a very simple form. If I look at part of my graph, which just has two vertices, remember that the vertices were superpotential terms, so the F-flatness constraint corresponding to the field in the middle here, x3, 1, 1, says that I take a product of all the edges on the ingoing vertex and equate it to a product of all the vertices on the outgoing vertex, all the edges on the outgoing vertex. So in fields, it's given by that. And let me explain what was on the bottom of that page in more detail. So the claim is that one can get out of order here. Okay, so let me just put this. The claim is that there's a way of associating the fields in the quiver. These are the xi, jk's that were these are my bifundamental chiral multiplets. There's a way of associating them to certain products of fields associated to matchings. So what do? I introduce, for each one of my six matchings, I introduce one of these p alphas. And now I introduce this intersection pairing where I say, if for every edge in my graph, for every each one of these edges in this hexagonal graph, if that edge appears in a certain matching, it picks up a 1, otherwise it picks up a 0. So this product here is just a product over all the matchings of the graph that contain a certain edge. This product should be over the matching, not the edges. So the claim is that each edge in my diagonal graph corresponds somehow to a field in the quiver. I've labeled it here with corresponding field. And the action correspondence is via this particular product of fields that I've associated to my perfect matching. So I'll explain where this comes from in a minute. But just for now, taking this formula, we can see how the perfect matchings solve their flatness constraints. And that comes about because, so here is a representation of an F flatness constraint associated to the field that I've arrayed. And so given a diver configuration that appears, that contains an edge on the left-hand side, it can't contain an edge here because it would be adjacent to the same vertex, and it must contain one on the next adjacent vertex. So for every diver that appears on the left-hand side, the same diamond configuration must also contain an edge on the right-hand side. And if we use the relationship from the previous transparency and plug it into the F-term constraint, every time one of these P alphas appears on the left-hand side, the same P alpha appears on the right-hand side. So this constraint is truly satisfied.
Sorry, what is that?
P alpha is, at this stage, just I'm introducing formally a variable that's associated to the perfect matching. I'll explain how one does that, in fact, now. But just if you just formally introduce, for every each one of my six matchings, I introduce the P alpha fields. There are six P alphas. And formally, if I just map an edge in the graph, this combination of those P alphas. And now I'll explain the geometrical meaning where this comes from. So the claim is here that each matching of my graph maps to a generator of the toric fan of the toric space M. So in some sense, these matchings encode the toric geometry of the Calabi-Yau, actually in a very concrete sense. These P alphas, they define a gauge linear supermodel whose moduli space is the toric Calabi-Yau. So these P alphas are fields in a gauge linear supermodel. It's the concrete meaning, and one can write down their charges I'll explain now how this comes about. So what we want to do is to map a perfect matching into data of a gauge linear sigma model. So the way you do this is first pick some arbitrary matchings. This is one of the six in this case. Fix this one, call it M0, And now for every other matching, including this one, so for all six, you look at differences of these matchings. What do I mean by difference? Because the edges, the vertices of this graph are bipartite, they have an alternating color, I can define an orientation. So I've chosen an orientation where I go from the filled in circle to the open circle. So then M minus N naught is going to define a set of closed curves on my graph. So I've chosen another matching here in red, and I've redrawn the matching M naught in green. So the difference of M minus M naught gives me a closed path here, and this edge appears in both of them. This cancels out. So the first step is differences between two match, between a matching and a reference matching, define some closed contours on the graph. And now you define a height function on the faces. So you start somewhere, we call it height 0, and then you define a height function on the other faces by when you cross one of these contours, the height increases or decreases by 1 depending on the orientation you cross with. So here I've chosen an orientation where, so I encounter, I'm going from here to here, I encounter the curve, the path coming to my left, I call that a height of plus 1. And if somewhere else there was I crossed the contour going the other way, I'd decrease the height. So this defines a height function on all the faces of my graph, and I look at the height change along the two periods of the torus. So here I don't change in going along that period, and I change by plus 1 in that direction. So the claim is that, so this defines a lattice point in Z2, and when you plot these points in Z2, you get what this is called the toric diagram of the space you start with. So here, this is the one that I drew. Now I didn't show, but there are 5 other ones which map 1 to here, minus 1, minus 1, 1 to 0, 1, and 3 to the origin. So these are lattice vectors in Z2, which you can extend to vectors in Z3 just by putting a 1 in the third coordinate. And these then define the generators of the toric fan of the space O-3 over P2 or C31 Z3. They're both the same fan, of course, same generators. So this procedure of looking at height differences across the curve defines the toric space, which is either the one we started with, if we're imagining putting D-brains on there, or if we have a Gauge theory to begin with, it defines the moduli space of the Higgs branch of the Gauge theory. And so finally, where these P-alphas come from is we can define a gauge linear sigma model by looking at the relation between these lattice vectors. And so here, there's one relation, which is if I take this one plus this one plus this one minus 3 times the last one, it vanishes, and we get a gauge linear sigma model with charge vector 1, 1, 1, minus 3. So that's familiar to string theorists from Wheaton's construction. So, more about the geometry. So these P-alphas, these fields in the gauge linear sigma model, we can use them to define, to exhibit the space as a Lagrangian T3 vibration. So there's a T3 fibered over, so you should think of this graph here as being a simplex in, well, it's going to be bound, so okay, each of these flat regions is a hyperplane that bounds the base of the fibration, and the coordinate of the hyperplane, the equation of these hyperplanes are given by equating the various fields to zero. So this is what's called in toric geometry the toric divisors. So PI equals zero is a toric divisor. We can call that D alpha. And so then these to revise the sections of, global sections of the corresponding line bundle. So, now, yes.
How did you get this figure from the Dynamo model? Or you didn't?
So the graph that appears here is actually the dual graph to a triangulation of the toric fan. So here is the one that I had. These are the lattice vectors that I got from the height changes. And now I draw some triangulation of this. This is the usual toric geometry procedure, but you triangulate the space, and then the dual graph to that triangulation shows you the degeneration locus of the T3 fibration. So what that means is, so there's a T3 fiber over here, which is given by phase rotations of the, it's given by, so there's a C star action which has weights 1, 1, 1, -3 on the various fields. So that tells me how the T3 is fibered over this. It's just related to the angular parts of the fields. So clearly over one of these boundaries where one of the fields vanishes, that means that one of the fibers of the torus is vanishing. So this graph here tells you how where the T3 is becoming singular. It's telling you what is the singular structure of the T3 fibration of the space. So it's another way of describing the same space. So
the Dynamo model uniquely specifies the toric fan, is that right?
Yes, so the Dynamo model tells you the toric fan. It doesn't give you a triangulation because that depends on the Kalin module, but it tells you where the points are. So that's enough to specify the, at least it specifies the external legs of this T3 vibration. It doesn't tell you what's going on in the middle necessarily. Right. So the point is now we've identified these P alphas as being either coordinates on the toric space or in physics language gauge linear sigmoidal fields. We can identify what this object is. This is the thing that let me relate the edge of my Dynamo graph to a field in the quiver, and this thing is the section of a line bundle which is given by the sum of the toric divisors. This is the same intersection pairing that I had before. So this provides a bit of geometry of where these, what does this this pairing mean? And it's like the equivalent fields are coming from a particular line bundle on the space. Incidentally, okay, any other questions before I continue? Okay, so this has given us a bit of a hint to the geometry that's encoded in these Dynamo models. And the question I'm interested in is how or where do these come from in string theory? One can take the prescription, this is a prescription, there's a set of tools for studying the certain gauge series, and lots of people have done that, but it's more interesting to me to ask where does it come from. And this was a question we partially answered in the work with VARPA last November. So there's a hint that, we can take it as a hint that the Dynamo model is related to mirror symmetry. So let me explain. The concept of the transparency is well known in to people who've worked on Dynamo models in mathematical physics. But there's an object, a matrix K, called the Castellane matrix, whose determinant counts the perfect matching for you. So if you're just interested in counting these things for some combinatorial or stat mechanism, there's a matrix that does that. And all it is the adjacency matrix of the graph, and then you add some factors of Z and W in a prescribed way. So it turns out, so this is the adjacency matrix suitably decorated. And now its determinant is this thing. So firstly, you can check that each term here corresponds to a matching. Now let me show you briefly. So one of them was x1 or a1, c1, and then a1, c3, and a1, c2. So that's, if you look at it, that's actually one of the matches of the graph. And, well, there are six terms in this determinant, and they count them all. So that's fine if you're just interested in counting them. But the interesting thing is that if I just rescale these various coefficients, which I can do, it turns out the symmetry of the Dynac model, I can bring it to this form. And this is the well-known expression for the mirror to the Calabi-Yau I started with. So more precisely, the mirror Calabi-Yau is specified by this equation. It's the same function as this function here, in terms of Z and W, which are C star value, and then I add two extra C value fields like that.
Sorry, where did Z and W come from?
So I didn't explain where this comes from, but basically it's related to you take your graph of the Dynac model. I'll explain that. Okay, so here's the graph that I had. And what you do is you look at paths that at period vectors of the graph of the embedding. And whenever, so take this one, whenever this crosses an edge, it picks up a Z or a W depending on the orientation of the crossing. So here it's crossing with one orientation, so let me call it a Z. I think I called it one over Z actually. And here is the opposite orientation, so that will get a Z. And similarly, if I take as my period vector I guess it's that one, but so you take so it's going to be again W and 1 over W there. So you just decorate the edges that are crossed by period vectors. And so there's a theorem that when you do this, the determinant of this matrix enumerates, the coefficients enumerate the matchings, and also they enumerate them with the grading, actually you take the degree of the coefficient in W and Z, and it's the same as the lattice point that I had before. So if you look at here's the polynomial I get. If you plot the Newton polynomial of this, which means plot the degrees in Z and W, there's three terms that appear at the origin. There's one term which is order Z, and there's one term of order W, and there's one term of order 1 over ZW. And that's the same, so those are the same vectors that I had before. So this is really just a mathematical version of mirror symmetry. The fact that it's been degraded. So this procedure suggests that these Dynac models have something to do with mirror symmetry. Okay, so let me first remind you of a few facts and then explain our proposal. So we were looking at the space C3 mod Z3, which has an orbital fixed point, and when we put some D3 brains at that point, they split into these three fractional brains which are labeling it by SI. So these SIs are fixed at the orbital point, but their sum gives me back the D0 brain, and the D0 brain is free to move away. One can also look at the same objects, the same SI fractional brains, when we blow up the P2 to large volume, and they turn out to be sheaves that supported on the exceptional cycle on the P2. So these SIs have some, well, they're only really well defined in these two limits in the B model, but in the A model, they're well defined everywhere in the mirror. And the third fact is that if I take the mirror to a point, so a point on M, then because mirror symmetry is roughly 5 wires T-duality, the mirror to a point has topology T3. So our claim, so we're interested where the Dynamo models come from. So our claim is we take a, I'm calling it a zero brain now, but it's a D3 brain sitting at a point on the exceptional cycle, so on the P2 or when the P2 has shrunk, sitting at the orbital point. Then the mirror to this point is still a T3, but now it's a slightly singular T3, and it has a structure of an S1 fibre over a T2. And the claim is that the locus on T2, where the S1 vanishes, is equivalent to the graph of the Dynamo model. So the claim is that the Dynamo models actually appear in string theory on the world volume of these mirror D brains. So one thing we'll see later is that that agrees with this proposal is that the faces of the tilings, the hexagonal faces, are equal in homology to the mirrors of the individual fractional brains. So we can extend the dictionary that I had earlier. This is the correspondence of these Dynamo quantities and Gauss theory quantities. And now with that proposal, we can say that the faces of the tiling on T2 are images of the fractional brains in the mirror, LaVR. The edges correspond to points where two fractional brains intersect, so they support the masses open string at the intersection point. And we'll see later on that the vertex, which encoded the superpotential terms, come from disk instantons in string theory. So suppose our P2 is blown up. So I just mean the D0 brain is sitting on the P2, not away from it. In principle, the D0 brain can move away from the P2. It can move anywhere. But when it's sitting on the P2 is when the mirror is describable in these terms. In some sense, this is the Dynamo models are only describing the compactly supported D brains, the ones that are supported on the exceptional cycle. And they don't support, they're like non-compact brains that extend transverse to the P2. Those aren't visible to the Dynamo model. So everything that the only things you can see are the sheaves supported on the exceptional cycle. Okay, so some review of local mirror symmetry. So here is the equation I had before. This is the one we can get from the Dynamo model by taking its determinant, or more generally, it's the same function that's well known in physics literature. But let's rewrite it as by introducing a new variable W, which is C-valued, and equating both terms equal to W. So what we're doing is describing the geometry as a vibration of two things over the C plane, over the W plane. And these two fibers are a curve, which is defined by the first equation, T minus W equals zero, which is a punctured curve in C star squared. And the second fiber admits the C star action, the just by multiplying, acting with lambda and lambda inverse on U and V. So the total space is the curve across C star, pi beta over C. So the interesting information is encoded in where that vibration degenerates. So firstly, it's easy to see where the C star action degenerates. It's when W equals zero. So the C star contains, there's a U1 component of this, and that defines an S1 in the C star fiber. And so at the origin, there's event that S1 vanishes. Just saying that phase rotations of the origin are fixed. So there's an S1 that vanishes at the origin, and in the other fiber, there's going to be a vanishing S1 when the curve becomes singular. So when the first partial derivatives of P with respect to Z and W vanish, also the curve vanishing by definition, defines these critical values W star. So we have this picture here. If we look at a path from the origin to one of these critical values W star, in the UV plane, the UV fiber, there's a circle which is finite away from the origin, but vanishes when we come into the origin. And similarly, in the other fiber on the curve, there's a one cycle that vanishes at the other endpoint, and it's finite everywhere else. So the claim is that the total space here, defines an S3 in the geometry, and this S3 is we identify with the mirror to the fraction of brains. So let's see how that's an S3. So the easiest way to see that is here, this is the equation for an S3 where Z1 and Z2 are complex. And if I write this in Z1 squared, Z2 squared plane, one squared plane, it gives me one of these line segments. And so you can see that the same thing happens as I was using before. Well, at one endpoint, phase rotations of Z1 are trivial, and on the other endpoint, phase rotations of Z2 are trivial. So that's precisely the situation we had. So indeed, this structure gives us an S3. The more useful way to think of it, though, is to combine one of the fibers with the interval. So looking just at this part gives us a disk, which is sort of stretched from the critical point and comes in towards the origin. So from this point of view, forgetting about the remaining fiber, the UV fiber for the moment, each critical point defines for us a disk, and all these disks come in and meet in the fiber above the origin. So the boundary of these disks must lie on some one cycles of the curve. Sigma zero is the curve defined by P of Z and W equals zero. So I'll be calling this sigma zero. This is really where everything goes on. This is the only place where these fractional brains can intersect, is in the fiber above the origin. One of the fibers is trivial, and the other one is this curve, so everything must happen in this curve. So this setup has been studied in the past by Hari Iqbal and Vafa, Nani and Iqbal, and possibly others. But previously, people were only able to get partial information out of this. They can compute the intersection number of these contours living on this curve, which means that they can see the chiral part of the matter of the quiver, and they miss any non-chiral matter that sometimes exists. And also, people didn't really have a good way of recovering superpotential terms. So what we'll see is that we can actually explicitly show how these disks, which bound one cycles on the curve, we can actually explicitly show what those one cycles do, and it's again related to the same graphs that we had before. So in that sense, the graph of the diamond model is going to define for us the intersection of the fractional brains, the topological properties of the fractional brains, and will give us the full data of the theory we want. So just briefly, here's the example that we've been looking at. Is the curve the mirror curve? And so they're going to be, you work out where the critical points are. There are three of them, and they lie on this circle centered at the origin. It's when here, 1 minus 3 times the third root of unity times the third root of Kähler parameter. So that agrees in this case with, we expect there should be 3 fractional brains. These are the 3 nodes of the quiver. I should probably have written, just for keeping your memory, this is the quiver we started with. So there were 3 gauge groups, which means we expect to find 3 fractional brains in string theory, 1 for each of them. And you can see this has the possibility to work, 0, 3. And in fact, it always works as long as this mirror curve is genus greater than 1. Okay, so the question is, how do you map from the diamond model that we've been looking at when it's embedded in T2? How do you get information about what's going on the curve? So, okay, the basic claim is that there's a map that takes an embedding of this graph, we think of the graph gamma, this hexagonal graph, as an abstract graph. So we forget about how we embed it into our space. We can choose to embed that graph into T2, and what I'll explain over the next few transparencies is we can take the same graph and embed it into the mirror curve sigma 0. So it's an isomorphic embedding, meaning all the properties of the graph are the same, has the same connectivity, has the same vertices, and so we can equally well think of the graph as being embedded on the mirror curve. And so there's a construction for doing this, which I'll explain, and the claim is that when we embed the graph on the mirror curve, it defines for us the properties of the fractional brains we wanted. So this transparency is explaining the first step of how to do that, mapping from embedding on T2 to embedding in the mirror. And it involves what are called zigzag paths. So a zigzag path is relative to an underlying graph, is part of the graph. And the zigzag path basically follows the graph along everywhere and it crosses along the midpoint of every edge. So here, it crosses along this edge, keeps going around, crosses on the next edge, and so on. So sort of zigzagging from one side to the other of the graph. You can give more precise definitions of this. A non-trivial fact about the kinds of graphs that are relevant for these theories is that every edge has 2 zigzag paths passing through it. So here I've drawn there are only 3 of them, the 3 zigzag paths that span this hexagonal graph I'm looking at. So I've drawn them as being zigzags, but in fact you can take anything homotopic to that. So in string theory these will be more like smooth contours, but for bookkeeping purposes it is drawn as angular. One thing you can see here is that the zigzag paths around each vertex have a consistent orientation. So here, if I trace around the vertex, the orientation is consistent. And the orientation differs, well, it's correlated to the color of the vertex. So here, it's enclosing the vertex on the right, and here, it's enclosing the vertex on the left. So this preserves the information about the bipartite structure of the graph, the colouring of the vertices. Okay, so one can. So there's an observation which, well, it's really, one can prove this, but for now, just take it as a fact that the zigzag paths on the graph are in one-to-one correspondence with either the external legs of this PQ web, which is the graph I drew before, and also to the punctures on the curve. So from the way you draw this curve is really by taking this graph and thickening it out. But it's the punctures, the points at infinity on the curve that define these zigzag paths. In particular, the whiny number of these paths on the two torus is the same as the slope of these lines in the plane. So one can prove that, but it's, it takes a bit of work. So we're going to use that in a minute, use that property that the zigzag paths are related to punctures of the curve. So now this, here's how we take our graph embedded in a two torus and map it to a graph embedded in the mirror Riemann surface. And it uses this operation called an anti-map. So this, what this does, you imagine taking the graph out of the two torus, and along every edge of the graph, you sort of flip it. So here, the zigzag paths cross along this edge, and we flip them so that they no longer cross, but now they remain on the same side of the graph. So, formally, the anti-map exchanges the faces of the graph with zigzag paths, because the zigzag paths here are now bounding the face of the new embedding, and similarly, what was a face is now becoming a zigzag path in the new embedding. So this is an operation, you just do this sequentially to every edge, and it changes the genus of the embedding, naturally, because you can't do this operation as it doesn't respect planarity. And so, well, what it turns out is that the graph we, or the surface we obtain after we do this can be identified with the mirror curve that we want. So in the interest of time, maybe I'll skip this. You can just check the, for example, check the Euler characteristic of the new graph and show that it has the right genus to be identified with this curve that we want. So in some sense, the new embedding of this graph gives us a model for the mirror curve. The point is that all we've done is we've changed the embedding of the graph. We haven't changed the properties of the graph itself. So things like what vertices are connected to what other vertices are the same, the order of each vertex is the same, the matches of the graph are the same because they didn't care about the embedding. And so in fact you can do better than just saying we've got some sort of simplicial model for the curve. You can actually again compute this determinant and the calculation is exactly the same, it's the same matrix. And you get an explicit algebraic formula for this curve. So it not only knows about the topological structure of the curve, but it also knows about the algebraic structure. So all we've done, and I'll show you the example, is we took our graph written on the T2, and then if you follow it through, this is what you get. You get a tiling of this curve. The curve has three punctures, and the punctures sit inside the faces of our new embedding. And you can check that, for example, here, this vertex is x313, 121, 232, and I should find it up here, is x313, x232, x121. So all the vertices, all the connectivity of the graph is the same, it's the different embeddings, embedding in a different surface. Okay, so now, so we have, if you like, we've inscribed the same graph, an isomorphic graph, onto this mirror curve, and so then just by by the properties of the antinap, you look at the zigzag paths in this new curve, this new graph. And these should be these used to be the faces on T2, and so these are still the fractional rays. So I've drawn them, and you can check that the intersections of these contours I've marked still encode for us both the quiver, for example here, intersections of yellow and purple. There are three of them, one there, one there, and one there. And those are the three arrows there. And similarly, the vertices, they were unchanged, but they're still bounded by closed loops of these three brains around each vertex. So in string theory, this is where we can attach an open string weld sheet. So one of these vertices of my graph corresponds to, well, I can consistently attach a disk there. And so in string theory, this contributes to the super potential by a disk instanton. So here, this is the open string weld sheet with three boundary insertions. And so it's going to contribute a term like this, super potential. And the area, well, you can normalize that to one by rescaling the fields. So this gives a nice explanation of where this term in super potential come from in string theory. And so previously, people had been able to compute some terms in the super potential using the B model, using A infinity products and very complicated technology. But this is a very nice, straightforward picture of why it should be that way. Okay, so this was a summary of what I've just said. So the claim is that these data models on T2 actually are realized in string theory, and they're realized using mirror symmetry. So we take the mirror to a D3 brain sitting at a point on the vanishing cycle of the clavier. The mirror is going to be a T3, and the T3 has a certain structure. It's an S1 fibered over a T2. The T2 is formed by joining together these various disks. These disks will glue together along some locus above the origin. And from this point of view, it's quite complicated to imagine how these things could glue together to form a T2. But using the properties of this map that I gave, this anti-map, you can actually show that clearly these disks span a two torus. So the T2 of mirror symmetry is embedded in a complicated way in the geometry, but using this anti-map, we can untangle it and show that it's really there. And it relies on the fact that the intersection locus of these various fractional brains, they intersect in the neighborhood of the graph, which is the graph of the diamond model. In particular, the S1 vanishes along this graph, or along the zigzag paths on the graph. Okay, so to conclude, using this point of view, so because we've mapped, on the B side, where the space we're looking at, we have to look at holomorphic sheaves on the exceptional cyclic with large volume, or we have to look at either boundary states or looking at representation theory for a singular point, and if we're in the middle somewhere, we don't have any idea how to define the D-brands. But using mirror symmetry, the geometry of the mirror to these fractional brains is classical everywhere. It's just these things are always just S3s, and we can actually find where they are in the geometry. And then by looking at it carefully, we can see that we can see explicitly where every intersection point of these fractional brains are. So this means that not only can we see the chiral part of the matter content, but if there's any non-chiral matter as well, you wouldn't see that if you're just looking at intersection numbers. But for us, we can actually count that as well. It also works for genus zero when the mirror geometry is less clear. One really nice thing is that you have a clear picture of where the super potential comes from. It's from the places where an open disk can be bounded by by multiple refraction rays. And we've at least taken some steps towards showing where this, these dynamos come from using mirror symmetry. I would like to be able to do better than this. So we only have a sort of a graph theoretical or a topological description of these contours and the embedding of the dynamo model on in the mirror geometry, which is good enough for answering some questions, but you'd like to really be able to derive, well, to find the algebraic description of these cycles. So there's some hope that this might be possible using a linear sigma model if you have a good explanation of where the of what the how to describe the mirror B brains, then using mirror symmetry one can try and describe the mirror A brains, which the claim is they should fit with this picture that I've described. Okay, so I didn't talk about it today, but there is also work on describing the topological B brains using dynamo models, using the same many similar techniques that appeared in a paper of Herzog, Nani, and Penveig earlier this year. So it'd be nice to relate these two things and really be able to show that the mirror to these fractional brains related to the B model proposals. And is this, I'll just end on this point, there's a really tantalizing model that was put forth in literature quite a while ago by Kunkel, Richard Tegen, and Buffer. These are the first guys that introduced dynamo models to string theory. And they were interested in the closed A model, but they used dynamos to describe sort of a microscopic description of the geometry. They had a way of looking at the statistical mechanics of these dynamo models and recovering from them in a limit the geometry of the mirror. The point is, it's the same dynamo models, the same graphs that we've been studying here. So in some sense, it suggests that the dynamo models up here that describe the fractional brains in the A model are some sort of boundary condition on this microscopic model. And it's sort of a self-similar boundary condition where the graphs that describe the boundary states, the D brains, are the same graphs that appear in a microscopic description of the same space. So this is very interesting, and I'd like to be able to understand if that can be made more precise. Then one can hope this might extend more generally. Okay, thank you.
Go ahead.